From beach towels to tea towels, and from mugs to water bottles, the TNT Shop has it all. Browse our shop now at tntradio.live. Critically analyzing global affairs, this is the Hervoy Moritz Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
We are getting through the week. It's already Tamale Thursday out here in Mexico. And speaking of Mexico, I don't believe I mentioned this news from yesterday. Tesla, Elon Musk's Tesla, eyes Mexico expansion, earmarking new export hub near Sonora lithium deposit. Remember, Elon Musk is the guy who says we will regime change countries to get their lithium. But they are preparing an assembly plant. He's eyeing a site near Mexico City for an assembly plant to ramp up expansion of the electric vehicles. So that is a very interesting development. While we've got Nuevo León governor begging Cobra Commander Klaus Schwab to visit him in Nuevo León. And yes, there's a lot of stuff going on in Mexico as well. In where is it? In Peru, Eve Engler put out a piece, interesting piece for Canadian Dimension. He was a guest of mine last year, and Professor Paul Robinson, who also writes on for Canadian Dimension, was recently with me as well to talk Russia and Ukraine. But Eve Engler is pointing out how Canadian mining firms dominate in Peru with almost $10 billion in total assets. And it's interesting that Canada's ambassador to Peru has worked hard to shore up support for Dina Boluarte's replacement usurper government, as he says, and that the Canadian ambassador to Peru has been meeting with Boluarte and Peru's foreign minister and mining minister. So again, we're seeing a lot of the same old imperial modalities where they are interested in Peru's resources, of course, Mexico's and other countries as well. You know, given the whole attempt to go to a green transition, rare earths, lithium, and all this stuff is becoming much more important. And what else we got going on? You sort of knew this was coming at the individual level. Once they try to cancel an entire country like Russia, there's no end to this madness. The EU has urged to sanction my childhood action movie star, Steven Seagal. Was it? I'm forgetting some of the names of the classics. I mean, there was Under Siege. There was that one that took place in Jamaica, that Steven Seagal film, Marked for Death, I think. Great 1980s action flicks. But a group of Western and Kiev legislators are now calling for Steven Seagal to be blacklisted. Because, why? For allegedly supporting Russia's military offensive in Ukraine? I mean, this is, if you ask me, this is crazy. This is thought crimes. This is like 1984 George Orwell. There's no justification. It's just because someone ideologically supports something, we should be blacklisting them. This is insane in Europe and the United States. I mean, it's already starting to happen to many people, including myself. And what's the worst that they want to do to Steve? It doesn't really go into details what exactly that would mean, but I guess sanction him, shut off his bank account. I would suppose this is the new world that we live in, very chock full of liberty, freedom, democracy, free markets, you know, that sort of thing. And I don't think I mentioned this one, but this one really irked me. Catholic school students kicked out of Smithsonian Museum in D.C., all because they were wearing beanies, like these little hats that had pro-life messages inscribed on them. and it said Rosary Pro Life. And apparently museum staff mocked the students, hurled expletives, and claimed the museum was a neutral zone where political or religious messages were not allowed. You know, you can walk in with a rainbow hat, no problem. If you ask me, that represents belief of a religious nature. So, but that's okay. But you cannot, you know, wear pro-life hat or a Jesus t-shirt in a mall. Recently, a man was kicked out of a mall somewhere in the U.S. just for wearing a Jesus t-shirt because it offended people. But if, you know, but the inverse is not true. If I see these other crazy things that offend me, I don't have a right there. I mean, what happened to the grit, the thick skin that we used to have in America? Just like, you know, whatever. If not being offended so easily, really, this that, you know, that sort of stuff shouldn't be bothering people. But snowflakes, it's snowflakes, as they say. A reminder that we have a smartphone app, the TNT Radio app. You can get it on your on the Apple App Store or Google Play. So you can download our app to your surveillance device and listen to us live anywhere, walking outside, doing chores around the house, so on and so forth. That's an easy way for you to stay up to speed on TNT Radio.
Headlines as they come in.
They have the breaking news.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
During an interview with CNN's Jake Tapper, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Bibi Netanyahu said people can get hung up on peace negotiations with the Palestinians, saying he has opted for a different approach. Before going ahead and getting hung up himself on peace negotiations between Ukraine and Russia, literally offering to broker the deal, here with the story, joining me now is TNT Radio News producer Adam Clark, a.k.a. Ruckus.
Thanks, Hervory, and it's quite a story. This is rich, in my opinion, but hey, I'll try to leave my opinion out of it. But I'm going to also try to break this apart, present it the way maybe Quentin Tarantino might, and jump around in different parts. So I'm going to start with Russia and Ukraine, circle back, and then circle back again. Anyone so much as speculating about sending weapons to Ukraine is escalating the conflict. So said Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova in response to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. What happened? In an interview to CNN on Tuesday, Netanyahu said, well, he said a lot of interesting things, but one of the things he said is that he did not rule out the possibility of sending Iron Dome missile defense systems to Kyiv, something which his predecessor rejected outright. Did he really say that, though? Not sure. Zakharova told reporters in Moscow, quote, all countries that supply weapons to Ukraine should understand that we will consider these weapons to be legitimate targets for Russian armed forces. Furthermore, she said, quote, any attempts implemented or even unrealized but announced for the supply of additional new or some other weapons have led and will lead to an escalation of this crisis, and everyone should be aware of this, end quote. Okay. So Zakharova was supposedly here responding to claims by multiple media outlets that Netanyahu was, quote unquote, certainly looking into the possibility of dispatching Iron Dome systems to Ukraine. However, the quote does not appear in CNN's write-up of the interview, nor the two video segments that were posted online. So, okay. However, what is posted online, what you can clearly hear him talking about, is the following. When he suggested that he might be willing, yes, Netanyahu, I'm sorry, just so you guys, in case you missed it, there's some conflict going on between Israel and Palestine right now, and it's certainly anything but peaceful. Just want to point that out. But this guy, he suggested he might be willing to mediate peace negotiations in order to help resolve the Russia-Ukraine crisis. Of course, only if U.S. President Joe Biden's administration doesn't object to this. Wow. Quote, if asked by all relevant parties, I'll certainly consider it, but I'm not pushing myself in, Netanyahu said. I've been around long enough to know that there has to be a ripe time and the ripe circumstances. If they arise, I'll certainly consider it, end quote. Netanyahu, of course, returned to power as Israel's leader in late December, starting his sixth term as prime minister after completing his latest political comeback. He told CNN's host Jake Tapper that he was asked to serve as a mediator in the early stages of the Russia-Ukraine conflict last year, but he didn't consider the offer because he wasn't prime minister at the time. He declined to say who asked him to mediate between Kyiv and Moscow. Quote, I said, well, I have a rule, one prime minister at a time, like one president at a time, Netanyahu said, adding that he considered the request to be unofficial and did not pursue the matter. Asked if he would play such a role now, he deferred to Washington, saying, quote, if I'm asked by both sides, and frankly, if I'm asked by the United States, because I think, you know, you can't have too many cooks in the kitchen, end quote. Oh my God. All right. I can't do it anymore, Hervory. I'm going to leave that behind. However, I just want to let everybody know what happened in the wake and since this interview. That's right. Israel launched airstrikes against several quote unquote terrorist targets in Gaza on Thursday morning, hours after a rocket fired from the area was intercepted by the aforementioned Iron Dome air defense system. The Israeli Defense Forces confirmed in a tweet about 3 a.m. Thursday morning, quote, the IDF is currently striking in Gaza, end quote. So lots of peaceful things happening out there. What do you think, Hervory? Should Netanyahu be the one who brings peace to Ukraine and Russia? Or should maybe he worry about his own backyard first?
Hey, I mean, if he can do it, why not? But as you point out, as Jordan Peterson says, you got to make your bed first. And so he hasn't made his bed out there in Israel and Palestine. So I think it'll be a bit difficult to make beds in Ukraine, so to speak. I just find it interesting. I think everyone's forgotten by now. I already forgot his first name, Netanyahu's predecessor, Bennett. What was his? I don't remember his first name. Someone can find it now. But he, early on in the war in Ukraine, was pressing Zelensky to work towards peace. So Bibi's predecessor, who was only there for a temporary, I don't know how many months. It was interesting. He wanted peace, but he was completely rejected. And now Netanyahu seems to be picking up the baton from Bennett in that regard. And so it seems like someone somewhere in the Israeli establishment, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how this works, but they do seem like they would want to solve this crisis or problem. And, you know, I do recall reading stories from some months back that I also find interesting that, you know, Russia has been kicking out, closing down a lot of, you know, NGOs, media organizations. And I do recall an article from RT, I think, discussing how Russia had also kicked out a large number of Jewish media organizations from Russia. So there's a lot of stuff going on, and it's confusing because I think the real reasons for all of these things are all, you know, it's deep politics. It's behind the scenes. So it's hard to decipher, you know, because this is all, everything's just run by deep politics. And we're not privy to a lot of these power structures and desires of these groups and peoples. And yeah, I don't really have much more information. But as you said, the renewed strikes in Gaza, I mean, it's like nothing new. Every week I hear, you know, Israel launches strikes in Damascus and then Palestine. And it's just, it's not news anymore. It's like a weekly occurrence.
And I think, if I'm not mistaken, they got a little bit more than just one thing going on there in Israel's backyard, I suppose. But in the actual write-up from CNN, it kind of basically opens up with his quote saying, quote, when, this is Netanyahu speaking to Jake Tapper, when effectively the Arab-Israeli conflict comes to an end, I think we'll circle back to the Palestinians and get a workable peace with the Palestinians, end quote. There was one of these pieces I was reading from here from RT, who said, here you go, talking about Iron Dome, short-range missile system. Yeah, we know that. Here you go. The previous government rejected Ukraine's demand, to send them over last October. Defense Minister Benny Gantz explained in November that Israel doesn't have, quote unquote, a large enough production base to satisfy Ukraine's needs, demands, while a senior military advisor said the country was loath to antagonize Russia, which has a large military presence in neighboring Syria. Israel's hypothetical change, of course, might have something to do with the U.S., which funds the Iron Dome to the tune of $1 billion a year. So whether or not that has anything to do with it, you folks decide on your own.
At the end of the day, the military industrial complex always wins. And yes, these Iron Dome systems, I mean, they're interesting. I think next week on my podcast, I'll be talking about some of this military nuclear stuff with an expert. But I did see they were trialing an mobile Iron Dome, on a naval carrier. So that was interesting. You sound better, Ruckus. It's good to hear you're healing. So I guess your sixth COVID booster shot is working its magic. So good to know.
Seven is heaven, my friend.
All right. I've got Robert Bryce on the line to talk energy. He does really great work. The phone lines will be open if you want to call in and ask a question. We'll be right back after this break.
TNT Radio's Alan Miller.
You campaigned for quite some time. Tell us a bit about the first round of impositions, because we now know it's been in all the press that Philip Glanville, the mayor of Hackney, is saying 75% reduction in cars. But how did this all start?
It was just the way that they were imposed without any... I mean, they're such major changes to the way we go about our lives. It was almost like the biggest changes in London since World War II, and yet we weren't told. Hackney did this 10-year transport plan from, I think it's 2015. I just dug it out again and had a look at it. There are no mentions of low traffic neighbourhoods. They do not mention them at all. And if you look at the results, there's about 50, I think it's 50, 54 people responded. This is an entire London borough. They reorganised the whole area for the next 10 years on 54 responses. And that's the utter breathtaking arrogance of all of this. It's almost hard to believe.
Alan Miller on today's News Talk, TNT Radio. A better business tip from TNT Radio. News Talk Radio listeners are some of the most active and involved listeners of any format. TNT Radio listeners rely on TNT Radio often as their primary source of information. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live. Like Bob Marley said,
get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
From big tech censorship to calling out government tyranny, TNT Radio has the guts to say what you're thinking and gives you the platform to be heard. Call the open line anytime in the U.S. and Canada. Call 1-888-201-6425. In the U.K., call 033-024-1026. And in Australia and New Zealand, call 1-800-670-310.
Stand up for your right.
Free speech has a home on TNT Radio.
All right, my next guest is all over the place. Books, films, speaking, Substack. Robert Bryce is the acclaimed author of five previous books, including Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper, How Innovation Keeps Proving the Catastrophists Wrong, as well as Power Hungry, The Myths of Green Energy and the Real Fuels of the Future. His articles have appeared in numerous mainstream publications, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, you name it. He's given over 300 keynote lectures to groups ranging from the Marine Corps War College to the Sydney Institute. He's been on Fox, Al Jazeera, again, you name it. And he's also the producer of a new feature-length documentary, Juice, How Electricity Explains the World. Subscribe to his Substack, robertbryce.substack.com, and find him on Twitter at PowerHungry, P-W-R, Hungry. Welcome to TNT Radio, Mr. Bryce.
Well, thank you for having me, Hervoye, but don't call me Mr. Bryce. My dad was Mr. Bryce. He's dead a long time now. You're going to piss me off right off at the beginning here. So,
all right, Robert, or do we
there
say Bob?
There you go. Now we're on the same level here. I had to ask your producer to pronounce your name, Hervoye.
Yeah, you got it. Everybody has to ask. No, it cannot be substituted with like Jorge or something. It literally means Croat, as in Croatian. So I'm a proud Croatian. And Robert, you know, I came across your work recently. I see, I was going through some of your catalog. I saw you not long ago interviewed Doomberg. I had him on my podcast last year. He does great work. And I'm really loving the work you do. You provide a sane, credible, level-headed take on energy issues, and there's a lot to talk about. I mean, there's people all over the place these days talking when it comes to energy. You know, there's this apocalyptic doomerism saying that we must shut down industry and civilization now. But you've been pointing out that, you know, doing so would cause great harm, impoverishment, and, you know, I think death by turning out the lights. And so to start, maybe to get your big picture view on energy, the energy crisis, you know, what's sort of your general thesis as to what's going on in the world?
Well, sure. Well, thanks. Yes, there is much to talk about. And I do a lot of public speaking, and I joke with my host. I said, well, I don't know what we're going to talk about. There's nothing going on. But I think, you know, one of the things that's top of mind right now, of course, is the Ukraine-Russia conflict and Russia's continuing attacks on the Ukrainian electric grid. And I've written about this. I mean, if you want to paralyze a modern society, you destroy their electric grid. And so the Russians seem like this is very calculated. I mean, they're not doing it all at once. They're kind of slowly degrading the Ukrainian grid, because I think if they wanted to, they could just take it all out all at once, but they're not doing that. Meanwhile, we have the mess in Europe, and it is an absolute mess. Although, you know, they've had a warmer winter, and so natural gas prices have come down dramatically. They were at $100, right at $100. The TTF trading hub in Holland is the benchmark in Europe, was at $100 per million BTUs in August. Now it's back down to, you know, $20 or so. So we've seen a reprieve kind of, you know, for Europe for now, but Europe is going to be in this energy crisis for years to come because of the shutoff of Russian gas. So meanwhile, in Asia, you've got this return to coal in a big way. So there are all these things that are happening around the world that I think confirm what I call the iron law of electricity, which is people, countries, and businesses will do whatever they have to do to get the electricity they need, including burning coal, including, you know, whatever it is. And so that's kind of one of the overarching themes that I've been talking about lately, Hervoy, is just this, people will not live in the dark. And I've seen this myself in making my documentary, going around the world in Beirut, in India. In Beirut, the Lebanese pay the generator mafia. In India, a lot of people steal electricity. I mean, this is just one of the realities of the modern world. And it is also the key disparity in the world today, the disparity between the electricity rich and the electricity poor.
And here in Mexico, where I am, they also steal electricity. And I'm always talking about it. I'm happy that here in Mexico, my monthly electric bill is like $5 to $10. My water bill is like $5 to $10. I don't need heating or cooling because it's a temperate climate. And so meanwhile, I'm hearing about other people in the US and Europe paying hundreds upon hundreds of dollars monthly for their energy. And just, you know, your further thoughts, where we're seeing our leaders, especially in Europe and the West, deliberately just shutting down coal and nuclear power plants and all of this stuff. And I think it's kind of crazy. I mean, what's your take on their reasons for doing that?
Well, first, you said you're paying $5 or $10 in Mexico. My daughter, Mary, moved to Los Angeles. So I live in Austin, Texas, and she moved to LA almost 2 years ago now. She sent me her most recent bill, $400. She lives in a small, you know, one bedroom house, and she's paying $400 for her power bill. I mean, and this is one of the things that really, as my late brother John Bryce said, grills my cheese. It's the regressive effect of these nonsensical policies that are being put in place, both in the Europe, but particularly here in the U.S., where we're shutting down our reliable generation forms of coal and nuclear plants, and building a lot of renewable energy that can't be dispatched. I'm here in Texas. We've had this massive ice storm, and for the last 2 days, wind and solar, I joke about it, wind and solar have been nowhere. I joke, they went to Cancun with Ted Cruz, right? They just have not shown up. And what are we relying on in this cold snap? Of course, it's fission and fossil fuel. So we're lacking a serious approach here in the United States. And it's not just at the federal level, it's the state levels. But I think we've also, you know, we're the U.S. policymakers are insanely enough following Europe's disastrous lead, and Europe drove itself into the ditch. A lot of people say, "Oh, this is Putin's fault." No. The Europeans, they screwed themselves when it comes to their energy and power sectors.
All right, we're going to have to jump to a news break. We'll be right back.
Have you heard the news?
Now, TNT Radio News.
This is the news.
This is James O'Neill with a check of today's headlines. A recruitment officer at the Royal Air Force resigned last year after finding about 160 cases of positive discrimination against better qualified male white pilots. Frustrated childcare workers in Australia who say they are overworked and underpaid are calling for an immediate 25% wage rise to help fix problems of high turnover in the industry. A Texas family has demanded a public apology after a SWAT team raided the wrong house.
We wear the PPE and wade through the muck so you don't have to. Never miss our thought-provoking take on the latest news and current affairs. Take TNT Radio wherever you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
And we're back with Robert Bryce. If you want to call in, the phone numbers are at the top of TNT Radio. .live, and I highly recommend subscribing to Robert's Substack, robertbryce.substack.com, and find him on Twitter, PWRHungry. And you mentioned renewables. Last year, I had on the program petroleum geologist Art Berman, who says that, you know, renewables don't cut it. In fact, most of the people that I've talked to said that they never will. They only make up a few tiny percentage points of the energy that the world requires, like something like 80% of the energy that we're all getting, like you mentioned, for electricity, heating, you name it, you know, gasoline for our cars, 80% is from hydrocarbons. Your thoughts on, you know, solar and wind and whether they will ever be able to, replace the large chunk of hydrocarbons?
Well, the short answer there is no. There's just no way. It cannot happen. You know, people forget, oh, well, solar and wind. Okay, great. They are only providing electricity. That ignores the just, it's a massive amount of energy that we consume in the form of liquid hydrocarbons, gasoline, diesel fuel, jet fuel. There's simply no replacement for those things. And why do we use them? It's not because there's some conspiracy and, you know, GM bought the patents to the Crate battery or whatever. No, if oil didn't exist, we would have to invent it. It is a miracle substance. When it comes to ease of handling, energy density, scale, our ability to transfer it very quickly. I mean, we can, you know, I pull into the gas station, the service station, I can refuel in 2 or 3 minutes. And then with that amount of fuel on board, 20 gallons, and weighs, 6.5 pounds a gallon. So, you know, 130 pounds, I can drive for 200 or 300 miles. I mean, it's incredible. But I've had Art Berman on the Power Hungry podcast as well. He's a very sober guy, you know, as you probably know, he's just, you know, he's no nonsense. But I think he has it exactly right. And one of the things, in fact, I wrote it on Substack today, is what's going on in Wyoming, and that these proposed wind projects are now the federal government is in the midst of potentially approving will be deadly for golden eagles in Wyoming. And I'm an avid bird watcher, and it just drives me crazy that this industry, the wind industry, and I'm a longtime critic, proudly so, they don't like me, I don't like them back, but their intrusion into rural America and their way that industry has been slaughtering birds and bats at massive scale and getting away with it. I mean, I just find it all just disgusting. And, you know, it's growing, but solar is going to probably grow faster, maybe. But, you know, the problem is there's just an enormous amount of money behind it. And the Congress has just approved even more money. So that's something like $240 billion in subsidies for wind and solar between now and 2030. Based on the latest Inflation Reduction Act passed by Congress last year.
Yeah, and on the note of wind, I mean, I've read that the turbines, you know, the wind turbines, after 20 years or whatever, 2 decades, they have to get rid of them, and you can't recycle them. They just throw them in the earth. They pollute the earth. I mean, they're just there. You can't do anything with them. And I was reading here in Mexico this week that the installation of wind power here in Mexico is slowing down. It used to be like 24% a year, and then down to 7%. And last year was only 2% in terms of installing, you know, wind power here in Mexico. And so I guess that's another question, you know, talking about this multipolar world. A lot of people are using this term where other parts of the world, you know, Russia, China, India, even here in Mexico, which has a lot of resources, they're not too keen on these green policies. China is keeping its coal plants. I think they're building new coal plants. They're building nuclear. What are your thoughts on, you know, one part of the world committing suicide, like Europe, and then another part saying, no, we're going to keep the lights on?
Well, that's exactly right. And the Indian government just recently announced that they're demanding that a bunch of their coal plants stay online. They previously announced that they expect their coal burn in India this year to go up by 8%. You apply the rule of 72. That means that they're going to double. Now, we'll see if they continue this torrid pace, but they'll double their coal consumption in less than 10 years. I mean, these are the realities around the world. And I've said the same thing for a long time, or more than 13 years now. If we're serious about reducing emissions, if we're serious, then the path forward is obvious. It's end-to-end, natural gas to nuclear. These are the two forms of energy that are lower, no carbon. They're scalable. The technologies are very well known. The deposits of natural gas globally are just, they stagger the mind how large they are. And many countries in Africa and other places in the world, they have natural gas resources, but they can't develop them. So this is the big challenge. And I think what we're lacking, both here in the United States and in Europe, is a really sober approach to these issues. And instead, it's a lot of glib talk. And you mentioned Mexico and the slowdown in wind. This is happening all around the world because of local land use conflicts. And I've documented it, and you can look on my website, robertbryce.com, the renewable rejection database. There have been, last year alone in the United States, were 79 communities across the U.S. rejected or restricted solar projects. They're all in over 100 since 2017, over 360 rejections of wind since 2015. All around the world, people are looking at these big projects and say, we don't want them in our neighborhoods.
Yeah, you mentioned Africa, and I had on not long ago Lawrence Freeman, who travels often to Africa and deals with things in Ethiopia and the dam over there. And he says many Africans describe this green agenda as an environmental dictatorship or a new form of colonialism, and that they view it as sort of a weapon to prevent the industrialization of Africa. And nuclear power is interesting. Last year, I had someone from the Canadian, I think, Nuclear Labs talking about small modular reactors, that in a few years, this stuff is going to be coming online, and then, you know, entire small towns will be able to use these things. What's the future for nuclear, in your opinion?
Well, I'm adamantly pro-nuclear, Hervoyer, that in my view, if you're anti-carbon dioxide and anti-nuclear, you're pro-blackout. Well, I am anti-blackout. I'm all day anti-blackout. I got blacked out here in Texas 2 years ago, as you know, you probably heard. But nuclear, it has an incredibly large promise, but the problem now is getting it to deployment. And what I see, unfortunately, I think in some ways, is the United States is not going to lead. I think the leadership will probably come from Western Europe, because they're in a tougher bind than we are. Now, just a little history. The U.S. still produces more nuclear power than any country in the world, almost twice as much as France. France gets a bigger percentage of its power from nuclear, for its electricity from nuclear, than the U.S. does. But the U.S. is now a lagging indicator. You look at Britain, Rolls-Royce is moving very aggressively to deploy an SMR, although it's not exactly small. I think it's 300 or 400 megawatts. But, you know, you look at Poland, Estonia, Germany, Japan. Japan is one of the best examples of countries all around the world saying, no, we're going to go back to fission, because we realize renewables can't scale. They are not reliable. And so we are seeing a renaissance, a big move back toward nuclear. The question is, in my view, and it's really the one that I've been following very closely, is which country is going to lead here? And it's going to be challenging, because you've got financing issues, you've got issues around supply chains, particularly with Russia, and they've been a big supplier of enriched fuel for a long time. But, you know, who's going to emerge as the leader here? I think that is a real interesting set of stories.
And this is not investment advice, but, you know, in terms of uranium, I was living in Kazakhstan from 2017 to 2020 and teaching there at Nazarbayev's Intellectual School. And I was telling my Kazakh friends back in 2017, because Kazakhstan has the world's monopoly in uranium, 40%, and they've got Kazatomprom. And I was telling my friends, hey, you should open stock accounts in Kazakhstan and purchase some Kazatomprom. And I remember at the time it shot up three times in price, Kazatomprom's stocks. And I think in general, you know, given what you're saying, and I'm reading China, other countries are going to be building nuclear, the price of uranium will go up. I mean, in general, just your thoughts on if someone is looking to invest in commodities or uranium, I think it's good, no?
Well, it's interesting. I had a guest on my podcast, Power Hungry Podcast, a few weeks ago, Adam Rosenzweig, and he talked about the opportunity in commodities more generally, not just uranium, but coal, oil, natural gas. But he's particularly bullish on oil because of what he says is underinvestment. And that's partly because of ESG, partly because of the Biden administration. But he just says, you know, he made the point I've made already, which was there's no replacement for oil. You know, wind turbines and solar panels don't replace oil. They back out some coal and some natural gas and probably some nuclear at sometimes. But the world's transportation sector still depends on liquid hydrocarbons. The uranium story and nuclear is a harder one to kind of play. And I'm not saying, you know, go out and buy coal or oil or natural gas stocks, because that's always volatile. But there are also pure plays in the SMR space. You have NuScale Power, which went public last year. They trade on the New York Exchange under the ticker SMR. I just looked at them. In fact, I'm working on the preface for the paperback of my book, A Question of Power, that's going to be out in May. And I was just working on it just a few minutes ago. Their market cap for this rank startup that has never made any money, $2.4 billion. That's the market cap. And then you got X Energy, which is another company. They have a gas-cooled reactor. They're planning to go public, I think, in May. So there's some very interesting things. Do Rolls Royce, I think, you know, if I had to say right now, which company might be the first one to really build this machine and make it public, get it deployed. Rolls Royce is not a bad bet because they're very well known. They already have the industrial manufacturing capacity. So, you know, how to handicap it. Geez, I don't know, Hervoy. I mean, it's just so complicated.
Yeah. And you mentioned ESG. Get your thought on that. The way I view it, after having read and talked to different folks, it seems to be like the social credit system or score for businesses. And, you know, a lot of people point to China, and this stuff is happening globally, but China seems to be the most advanced. I mean, I saw a clip yesterday of someone in China walking around these vending machines saying they don't take cash anymore, or different shops where they just use facial recognition or your palm scan. And they're like, they beg the question, well, you know, how could you resist this? And then they go on in the video to say, you know, you just simply pay with your face, which is linked to your online account like PayPal. Less than a year ago, I was banned from PayPal. And so in any case, that's a different tangent. But ESG now is doing the same to companies that don't toe the line to, you know, the different aspects of the climate agenda. They're getting refused capital. I know I've seen pushback in states like Louisiana and I think Missouri, who've pulled out like $1 billion worth of their investments. But what's your take on the damage being done by ESG?
I think ESG is a cancer on capitalism. I mean, you have an unaccountable set of people who are deciding what it is that's investable. And, you know, I joke about it, but I think there's a lot of truth in it. What does ESG stand for? Well, the E stands for emissions and the S and G are silent. I mean, you know, this is like, well, it's all about carbon. Okay, well, fine. So then I noted in my Substack piece this morning on this, the title is Wyoming Wind Projects Pose Profoundly Dangerous Threat to Golden Eagles. And they do. But NextEra Energy, which is the largest producer of renewable energy in the world, they got prosecuted last year, and I was glad to see it, by the Department of Justice because they purposely and knowingly built wind turbines in the middle of Golden Eagle habitat after being warned three times by the federal government not to do it. And the project they built was called Cedar Springs. You want to know how corrupt the whole ESG thing is? NextEra put a picture of their Cedar Springs project in their, a very prominent one, in their ESG report. It's like, oh. So environmentalism doesn't include protecting eagles. You can slaughter the eagles because you're putting up a wind project and you call that ESG. I mean, I don't even know how to satirize that. I mean, it's just so absurd on its face.
Yeah, and you know, another part of everything that's going on, we mentioned briefly, I think, EVs or renewables earlier. You had a piece last month. You mentioned the Swedish rare earths and how because Sweden apparently discovered rare earths, and that their discovery won't dent China's monopoly for decades. And I'm reading today from Bloomberg that the German chancellor is traveling Latin America, and he wants to help secure additional supplies of lithium from, I guess, Chile, the world's second largest supplier of lithium after Australia. Mexico just nationalized our lithium here. They call it, I think, Litmex or Lithiomex, like Pemex, everything X. And you know, Tesla is looking to build a site here in Mexico City as well. And just your thoughts on lithium. I mean, Peru, there's rumors that, you know, we had a coup d'etat recently in Peru. Maybe Canada and US are, you know, Canadian miners are interested in the lithium in Peru. And so, but they also do damage. This stuff does great damage. And the batteries, you know, after so many years, they're worthless. They explode and they cause a lot of harm.
There's no recycling for lithium ion batteries. It doesn't exist. There is no, you know, I'm pretty familiar with the battery sector. I've toured lead acid batteries, and one of the largest lead acid battery factories in the world, in fact, in Lyons Station, Pennsylvania. And they very carefully screen out lithium ion batteries because they're so dangerous. But they've explained to me, and it's very clear, they can't recycle them at anything like scale. And so we're producing now these lithium ion batteries by the billions, but no one's talking about end of life. And the other thing that I think is really the important point, I appreciate you mentioning the Substack piece, because yeah, Sweden found this deposit of ore that can contains a lot of rare earth elements, neodymium, praseodymium, terbium, dysprosium. All of these are so-called green elements. Well, that's fine, but they're a decade or more from producing any of that ore, getting that ore out of the ground. But the key here, Hrvoje, isn't necessarily even that commodity, that neodymium itself. It's the magnets. It's turning that stuff into a usable end product. So a point that I made in another Substack is that marketplace for those neodymium iron boron magnets, which are the high strength magnets that go into electric vehicles and wind turbines, China controls 90% of the global market. This is according to the DOE. 90% of these neodymium iron boron magnets, which are doped with terbium and dysprosium, usually to make them work better in high temperatures. The entirety of this idea around energy transition, it's all a China story. I mean, the China control electrolyzers, the magnets, the production of the rare earth elements, copper, nickel, cobalt. It's a Chinese story. So there's this blind kind of push to move, you know, oh, green, you know, I don't call it green, alternative energy. It's all playing into the hands of China's supply chains. And I'm not a China basher. China's going to take care of China. But who's thinking about this? I mean, it's just ridiculous to me in a lot of ways.
I wanted to come back and continue on the lines of China. We got to jump to our break. Again, the Substack is robertbryce.substack.com. That's BRYCE. And you can follow him on Twitter at PWR Hungry. We'll be right back on TNT Radio.
With his expert analysis and opinion,
this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
The reason the fascist FBI censors conservatives so hard on social media is because the left simply can't meme, and they've got no Twitter game whatsoever. The White House got absolutely ratioed today on the official @CDCGov account when it put out a video that asked,
"Can I get my Mpox vaccine at the same time as my flu shot and COVID vaccines?"
Check out the video. I'm not far off on the voice. And they had Dr. Dimitri Daskalakis, who looks crack-a-lacka, all tatted up in his leather bondage gear. Yes, that photo really is he. Who replied,
"It's not too late to get vaccinated. You can get the Mpox vaccine at the same time as your flu and COVID vaccines. But talk to your vaccinator about what's right for you."
First of all, Mpox? Do you mean monkeypox? And talk to your vaccinator. People have vaccinators now? Or did they misspell executioner? Check out the comments. They're savage. People are waking up. From MAGAinstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Governments around the world are wasting billions of dollars in carbon capture and storage. Such programs oppose the benefit of enhanced photosynthesis for a greener world and improved crop yields. Much of the funding goes to geosequestration, which requires vast amounts of energy to pump carbon dioxide deep underground into geological formations. It would be better described as oxygen burial, given oxygen makes up 73% of the mass of carbon dioxide. For most of the last 600 million years of life on Earth, atmospheric carbon dioxide concentration exceeded 1,000 parts per million. And for much of that time, including when the dinosaurs roamed it, it was over 2,000 parts per million. Today, it is only about 415 parts per million. Burning fossil fuels liberates carbon back into the atmosphere from which it came.
I want to say this, and I'm going to say it just once.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
We're in our final segment with Robert Bryce. Phone lines are open if you'd like to dial in. Numbers are always at the top of TNTradio.live. And again, I highly recommend Robert's work. A lot of books he's published. You can find them all on Amazon and subscribe to his Substack, robertbryce.substack.com. And just continuing on the lines of China, you know, we got this new Cold War between West and East. We've got military conflict with Russia and Ukraine that could any day, you know, turn into World War III. And that's not an exaggeration. And then we've got this, as you were alluding to, this economic tech war with China. As you're saying, they've got the rare earths. People like, what's his name, Kai-Fu Lee talks about how China is leading in AI. And then we've got the semiconductor issue. You know, how do you see this space and where things are going between, you know, the U.S. And China?
Well, it's worrisome, and it's almost as though there's a contest to see who's going to blink first. I mean, and particularly given these recent announcements that China was going to now restrict the export of some of the technologies for solar panel production. And if you have China restricting the export of neodymium iron boron magnets or other technologies, electrolyzers, the, you know, this energy transition that is so much, there's so much hype around it. Well, then we're just handing the keys to the car to the Chinese government. So I just think, you know, it's interesting. I'm 62 this year, Hervoy. I look back and, you know, when I was a kid, 1973, we had the Arab oil embargo. And, you know, since then, there's been this focus among policymakers here in the U.S. and more generally in the West about the issue of import dependence. And I wrote about this in my 13 years ago in my fourth book, Power Hungry, pointing out that we may be just trading one kind of dependence for another, right? Instead of importing oil, we're going to import now these other things from overseas, particularly from China. But we need more rationality. We need a sober approach to where we are in our energy and power networks. And unfortunately, I just don't see it. Even in Europe, I mean, it's remarkable to me to see how, despite the catastrophes that they're facing, they're still planning on closing their nuclear plants. I mean, what in God's green earth are you doing? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
Well, you know, that's my next question, trying to project out. I've interviewed Ralph Scholhammer, an academic in Europe who does good work. And he kind of likened this to this, our Western elites basically, you know, I forget how he put it, but civilizational suicide, something like that. And then I had Michael Yon on last year, and he's a bit extreme. He's, you know, projecting a global Holodomor, like famines. And then, you know, we've got the issue with the fertilizers in certain countries there, like we saw in Sri Lanka. I think that was to do with ESG. They're saying we can't use fertilizers anymore. What do you see the further effects of this? I mean, I see the middle class sort of being wiped out, and I mean, it's sort of bringing us back to the feudal ages, like medieval times, where you've got basically the rich and the poor. You know, your further thoughts on consequences here.
Sure. Well, and this is a point that my friend Joel Kotkin has made many times, and he calls it the new feudalism. And I had a piece again in Substack just last week about the billionaires behind the gas bans. You have a super elite and super mobile elite who are funding a lot of these efforts here in the U.S. and I think around the world on these alternative energy technologies and banning the use of hydrocarbons. It's all regressive, Hervoye. I mean, all of this, whether it's, you know, California banning the sale of internal combustion engines, whether it's these prohibitions on using natural gas in the home and businesses, even though it's the most affordable form of in-home energy. It's all regressive. It all, excuse me, I could say F's the poor and the middle class. I mean, all of it. And yet there's no discussion of this, essentially, by either by the legacy media outlets. And I'll tell you just one quick vignette. So this one really does grind my gears. There's a New York Times reporter named David Gellis. He did an article on land use battles in Ohio over wind projects. And he casually mentioned in the article, oh, and some of these activists are affiliated with Koch entities, right? The Koch brothers, right? Like this is disqualifies them. And this is the part of the corruption. And a few weeks later, he's in Davos, you know, covering the World Economic Forum. And I thought, well, this isn't just an elite. This is a super elite. He's a reporter. He goes to rural Ohio and like, oh, they pats him on the head. Oh, these stupid bumpkins out here in rural America don't know what's good for them. But he's hanging out in Davos. He thinks he belongs there. But to me, it's just such a classic distillation of kind of how the elites, and I don't use that word with any relish or any joy, they don't have any clue about how the working class people, the people who turn wrenches, how they live, and they don't care about them. And so that's behind a lot of this, I think. It's just a very elitist kind of class issue. And that's how Joel identifies it. And I think that's exactly right.
Yeah, Joel Kotkin's work is awesome. I've got his book here in hardcover with me. I haven't had the time yet to read it, but I've listened to his interviews and read his articles.
Have him on the show. He's irascible and funny, and you know, he's a New Yorker, but he's lived in California for all these years. He's got a great accent. He's a dear friend of mine, but he's got a very sharp view on these issues, and he sees it all as a class conflict. And I think I think that's right. That the battle in the United States and largely around the world today, it's not about left versus right, conservative versus liberal. It's about class and a lot of this climate change activism. And I'm not saying we ignore climate change, but a lot of the activism and the funding of it, it's about class and these, elites from, fancy universities working in lavishly funded NGOs, Sierra Club, NRDC, the rest of them. They don't care about the working poor. They don't care about those people. They don't get their money from them. So it's like, well, F them. We don't need to. We don't need to talk to them. We're going to tell them what they can do.
Yeah, I mean, it's this smug, as some people call it, the laptop class. I mean, we saw during the pandemic that they were,
the
doing
keyboard,
just great.
The keyboard economy. That's what Jennifer Hernandez calls it. The keyboard economy.
Yeah, and everyone's, middle class, lower class is getting their businesses shut down. And, I was around these people as well. I studied diplomacy in Geneva, and I taught at the Tec de Monterrey, the top school in Mexico. And they were the only university in all of Latin America to officially be invited to Davos, to the World Economic Forum. So, yeah, these people are just, as you say, smug and think they know everything. We got a couple minutes left. I did want to bring up, I guess it's along those lines that they think they're sort of like gods. And I saw you did an interview. I only caught the interesting part. I fast forwarded to the interesting part related to geoengineering. And I guess your guest kind of left early. And I think he was trying to make the case that, we need to block out the sun. Like Bill Gates is talking about, blocking out the sun. I mean, for me, this is kind of like King Canute stuff. It's like, we're meddling with the forces of nature. Like we have no idea what we're doing. The consequences, I don't see any way it being a good idea for us to black out the sun. Your thoughts
is geoengineering. Yeah. Or what do they call it? Yeah. There are different terms for it, but yeah, that guest that I had on, David Keith, one of the most arrogant people I've ever talked to. And I've done a lot of podcasts. So, 160, 170. He was just insufferable. I mean, it was an interesting conversation, right? But I mean, Mexico's on the front lines of this, right? They just recently just said that, no, you can't do that. There was some guy who did one small experiment, but this idea that we're going to put sulfur in the atmosphere and that's going to block out the sun and we're going to find the right ratio. I mean, it is very, there's a lot of hubris involved there. And how would you get any, I mean, we can't even get international cooperation, Hervoye, to ban landmines. How are we ever going to get any kind of international cooperation on geoengineering? I just don't see it happening.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. We're about 2 minutes to midnight. And, just one more thing that, you talk about gas stoves. Some Saudi ministers at Davos a few weeks ago were saying in the future there will be no cars. Even Xi Jinping in foreign policy, I was shocked last week. I read Xi Jinping, apparently he's prototyping his own city in China. It's a personal initiative where in the future 90% of the transport will be public. So that means there's not going to be cars. And they're talking about not eating meat as well, that we can't. Bill Gates actually, I think, came out and said in America, we should all stop eating meat because, you know, we're wealthy, and switch to his synthetic meat. And so anyways, we got about a little over a minute left. You know, any final thoughts? And then if you want to tell us about all of your projects and best places to find you.
Well, thanks. It's been a pleasure, Hervoye. And, you know, I love this stuff. I'm passionate about it. This is my calling in life. And I say that with, you know, it sounds a little pompous, but this is where I live. And I'm this is what I plan to do until I can't do it anymore. But yeah, I'm making my documentary is called Juice, How Electricity Explains the World. It's free. You can find that on juicethemovie.com. I'm on Substack, robertbryce.substack.com. My podcast, The Power Hungry Podcast. I'm fully employed. It's difficult not to find me on the Google, but it's been a pleasure. I really, hope we can do it again.
Yeah, you're welcome back anytime. And like I said, I'm going to be getting your books, purchasing the documentary. It's a gold mine of stuff. You're very energetic and you're covering energy. So that's really great. So again, everyone check out Robert Bryce's work, and I'll be right back after this break.